Welcome to an HBO podcast from the HBO Late Night series, Real Time with Bill Maher.
Start the clock.
You people have been smoking covfefe. You know what covfefe is, right? Covfefe? Show the tweet. Donald Trump tweeted this week, despite the constant negative press, covfefe. The V is silent. That's the secret to the word covfefe. Everyone's mispronouncing it this week. It's like the H and more. Covfefe. Leave the V. Covfefe. This is the part of the assisted living facility commercial where the grown-up children say, that's when we knew Dad could no longer live on his own. Living in the era of covfefe. And, you know, I've heard people say, this is no big deal. What? You know what? The last thing I want to hear from this White House is, his fingers just pressed the wrong button. But not to worry. This morning, President Trump put Jared Kushner officially in charge of covfefe. So that's taken care of. Now to the big news. America's long nightmare as the world leaders is coming to an end. The clown who runs our country, the laughingstock on the world stage that is Donald Trump, pulled out of the Paris Climate Accord this week, as you know. I know. How brave of you. A meek. Anyway, I still have faith in liberals. Anyway, yeah, isn't that sad? I feel like I'm binge-watching the fall of the Roman Empire set to the music from Benny Hill. You know, I usually wake up to the sounds of birds chirping. I opened my window today. A sparrow went, fuck you. I mean, it is hard to exaggerate how alone America is on this issue. 190 countries in the world signed on to the Paris Accord. That's pretty much all of them. North Korea signed. Really? The country that is always threatening to blow up the planet wants to save the planet. Not just every country. Corporations, greedy fucking corporations are for this. ExxonMobil is for this. The CEO of General Electric said he was very disappointed, which hurt Trump because he thinks he's a general. I mean, everybody gets this but Donald Trump and the Republican Party. Google is for the Paris Accords. Apple, the Vatican. Google, Apple, and the Vatican, that's the axis of virgins. Everyone is on this page, but Trump says no, no. He said he listened to his advisors. You know, he's got great people around him. They said they gathered all the data and they all came to the same delusion. That we have to focus on bigger threats, like Kathy Griffin's photo shoots. The things that really matter. Donald Trump says he's going to renegotiate the deal because nobody negotiates better than Donald Trump, really. Says the guy who cannot even get his own wife to hold his hand. Yeah. But you know why? It was all in the paper today. You know why he did this, probably? Okay, so yesterday he makes a big speech in the Rose Garden, soon to be the Cactus Garden. And he says, we don't want other leaders of other countries laughing at us anymore. And they won't be. Okay, they weren't laughing at us, you waddling outhouse. They were laughing at you. You know. The thing is, no, here's what happened. He just got back from his big overseas trip, and the European leaders screwed up. They didn't kiss his ass like the Saudis did. They didn't put his face on buildings and let him stroke their orb. And the Pope made a fat joke about him, and the French guy said he won the handshaking contest. You guys were mean to me. Now you get coal. Get coal. What is it, the Santa Claus doctrine? Donald Trump is not going to let those Euro-weenie countries like France and Norway tell him he can't use hairspray. He needs a lot of hairspray. Is it any wonder that 43% of registered voters in the last poll say they want him impeached? And until he's impeached, they say they'd like some of whatever Tiger Woods is on. All right, we got a great show. Elliot Spitzer, Rebecca Traister, and Jim Vandehei are here. And a little later, we'll be speaking with technology ethicist Tristan Harris. But first up, he's the junior U.S. senator from Nebraska and author of The Vanishing American Adult, Our Coming-of-Age Crisis and How to Rebuild a Culture of Self-Reliance. Please welcome Senator Ben Sasse. Senator. Hey, Senator. Oh, I appreciate you being here.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. No, I mean it. I appreciate it. You're a Republican. There are some Democrats who won't come here. I say this about the Republicans. They got bigger, you know what?
Go-fe-face.
Right. And I have to say, your book, I've been preaching your book for like 25 years on television, that kids are spoiled and entitled and they have to stop kicking the back of my seat on the airplane. And I feel like, first of all, let's bond over this before we get to the stuff where we're going to argue.
All right.
Okay. Your book is so right about how we kind of have actually lost the thread of what adults are anymore in this country. Adults, they wear shorts everywhere and they have cereal for dinner and they treat comic books like they're literature. What is your prescription for this problem?
More cereal for dinner. I mean, so first of all, let's not disagree on everything. So this is a constructive project, right? I'm not trying to beat up millennials, but there's something weird in human history if you can't tell 10 and 15 and 20 and 25-year-olds apart, because that's new, right?
Right. I mean, right.
Adolescence is a gift.
Halloween used to be a kid thing.
It's not anymore?
Not out here.
Okay.
No, adults dress up for Halloween. They don't do that in Nebraska?
It's frowned upon. Yeah, we don't do that quite as much, but...
Wow. I've got to get to Nebraska more.
You're welcome. We'd love to have you work in the fields with us.
Work in the fields?
That's part of that. That's...
Senator, I'm a house nigga. No, it's a joke. Thank you. You're still working in the fields out there, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, we want our kids to suffer.
Let's get to that.
Okay.
Let's make kids suffer. I'm so on the page.
We need to celebrate scar tissue more together. Scar tissue is the foundation of future character.
Right.
And ultimately, a huge part of coming of age is learning that production is more likely to make you happy than consumption. Consumption has a lot of important uses, obviously. But ultimately, when you go from being a kid, which is a dependent state, to being an adult, which is an independent state, it's pretty great that you had this adolescent transition period to get from one to the other. We don't think just because you hit puberty and you become biologically an adult, you don't have to be financially, morally, household leaving-wise, school quitting-wise. You don't have to be an independent adult immediately. But you're supposed to transition in an intentional way. You don't want to be stranded in Neverland. Peter Pan was a dystopian hell.
It's so great to see a politician, first of all, write a book about something, as opposed to, you know, those books where they got the arms folded on the cover and it's, you know, fates, flags, and fetuses. And...
I've not seen a lot of fetuses on the book cover. Maybe we're going to different stores.
All right. But you homeschool your kids?
We do hybrid schooling. So our kids are 15, 13, and 6. And I'm one of 5 people in the Senate who's never been a politician before. I think I'm the only person in the Senate that does a family commute. So I take a kid with me every week. I travel to D.C. on Monday morning. I come home on Friday night. My wife tells me which kid annoyed her most that week. They become my date for the next week.
Well, there's another guy in Washington who was never a politician. And that's another thing we agree on. You're not a fan of Donald Trump.
I think that the president's...
You didn't vote for him.
I did
You're a Republican who didn't vote for Donald Trump.
I'm...
I mean, you can be proud of that, Senator.
I called the 2016 election a dumpster fire. We have 2 political parties right now in this country that are really, really exhausted. When you give the American people the choice, do you think of yourself more as a Democrat or more as a Republican? When you don't give them a none-of-the-above option, 46% of the public interrupts to say, I don't want anything to do with either of those parties. It's about 29% Dem, 25% Republican. And then when you drill down inside that 54% who will even answer the question, the main reason people identify with one party is because they're more against the other party, not because they think their party is for stuff that they think is going to solve the challenges of 5 and 10 years out.
But you would agree that, and I am a critic often of the liberals, and I hear it from this crowd, they boo me in my own studio. But you would agree that the Republicans at this moment in history are more embarrassing, would you not? I mean, you must be a little bit embarrassed on a weekly basis that this president is on your team.
Yeah, so I don't really think of myself as on either of these teams. I'm one of the more conservative members of the Senate by voting record, which means that of the stuff we're voting on, from Democrat to Republican, I'm for more market-oriented, localist, decentralized solutions. But this debate is a lot less interesting than the things we should be debating, and we're not voting on any of the big things. We're not dealing with national security strategy for the age of cyber and jihad. We're not dealing with the shortening duration
of jobs. Well, that's partly because the president gives away intel to the Russians in the Oval Office. Stuff like that, which I assume would bother you. I mean,
I'm against that.
Are you? Yeah. All right. But I mean, when are the Republicans going to start putting country ahead of party?
Yeah, I mean, there's a big problem in the country when the number one driver of how people think about Russia right now is whether or not you were for candidate X versus candidate Y in the last election.
Right.
And Putin is an enemy of free speech, free assembly, free press, freedom of religion. And that shouldn't be a Democrat versus Republican position. That should be an American position.
I agree. But I feel like In places like Nebraska, it would be easier to get elected as a Russian than a Democrat. Don't you think this country would be better off if a Democrat could get elected in Nebraska? And please tell me why Democrats in a place like Nebraska, why it's unthinkable. Why do they hate Democrats that much? I get that there are problems.
Yeah, I really do think both political parties are living a hangover from the 1960s, and they're trying to fight retro fights right now, and I don't think either party has a vision for what are we trying to solve 5 and 10 years from now. I really don't think that we have thought through what happens when
I'll tell you what I'm trying to solve 5 and 10 years from now, which is climate change. And this was not a good week for that. Now, I know you didn't sign the letter that 22 Republican senators signed imploring Trump to do what he did. But your record on the environment, I could read it. I'm not gonna. I could.
I believe you are literate.
It's not good. League of Conservation Voters, you get a 0%. Environmental America, 0. Defenders of Wildlife Action, 0. Earth Rights International, 0. Not good. Please, you're a smart man. You went to Yale, Harvard. You were a college professor and a president of a college. Help me understand.
Well, first, let's just be clear. I went to Harvard and Yale not because they have great academics, but because they have crappy enough sports that they'd let me play. So let's first just get...
Oh, is that right?
Set, like, if I could be playing for Nebraska, I'd have been there.
Okay. All right. All right. But I must insist you're a smart man. Help me understand how a smart person can be as agnostic on the environment as you are. And I know the talking points have changed. I know you guys don't want to be called deniers anymore. So you kind of bullshitted your way around that. But it's not on your top three.
That's fair. That's fair. It's not my top three. Let's parse a couple
different things. Not your top three important issues.
Let's parse a couple different things. First is climate change. I believe that the climate is changing, and I do believe that carbon energy sources contribute to that. Now, there's a separate question, though, which is, what's the cost-benefit of different solutions we're debating? And then there's a third question, which is, where is the public on what I think of as mostly symbolic gestures? And so I think if you look at something like Paris, this climate agreement, one of two things are true. It either really is going to make a difference on the long-term growth of temperature, or it's not. And I don't think you can have it both ways. If it really is going to make a difference, it's going to be incredibly cross-prohibitive to do it this way. So most of the UN
prohibitive.
Data,
why?
Well, most of the UN data on what's going to happen over the next century hasn't been borne out by a lot of the data from 2000 about what would happen by 2015. So when we speculate all the way to what happens by 2100, there are debates anywhere between 2% and 5% climate degrees increase.
Mm.
How much does Paris affect it? By most UN calculations, it's something like between 0.1% and 0.3%. So it's not enough to make any real difference, but it is enough to harm a whole bunch of people economically. So I think we need to have a debate.
You really believe that? You really believe that going back to coal, and I know coal is big in Nebraska, but you also
use public power states, so Nebraska ends up with a lot of coal out of Wyoming.
But you think we should? I've read that you think we should use more coal.
I don't know that I've said that. I think we should think about where you're going to get innovation in the long term and not try to drive us back 50 or 100 years in economic history right now. Let me posit the question another way. If you're sure that carbon-based fuel sources are the worst thing, why wouldn't you be for just making all of it illegal immediately?
Illegal is a little harsh, but certainly a carbon tax.
But
certainly
are you gonna...
making it more expensive.
It's an important debate, right? But this is what I mean by the cost-benefit. Either carbon is so bad that we should get rid of it really fast, no matter how much it costs, or it's not quite as bad and we should debate the costs and the benefits, right? That's the debate I'd love to hear.
That debate has been over for a very long time, and I think we all know that. I don't understand why the foot-dragging. Could I read you something that Dick Cheney once said about terrorism?
Sure.
It was called the 1% doctrine. He said, with a low probability, high-impact event... He was talking about terrorism, but I'm talking about climate. You have to look at it a completely different way. If there's a 1% chance that Pakistani scientists are helping al-Qaeda build a nuclear weapon, we treat it as a certainty in terms of our response. Why not that with climate, which is much more than a 1% chance?
So I get your insurance policy doctrine here, but again, I think you have to ask, how much will the U.S., having a huge economic impact negatively on our ability to innovate, make a difference to the global temperature if China and India are going to continue to be the main drivers of
this
carbon?
This premise that it hurts our economy. There are, as everyone on TV is pointing out all week, there's only like 70,000 jobs in coal. It's like building an outhouse in Nebraska to go back to coal. Whereas the new future, I mean, Tesla has 10 times the stock market price as GM, even though they don't make a profit yet. Because those smart people on Wall Street, the smart people who know business, they can see the future. It's not with fossil fuels.
Yeah, but you just said, so it isn't just about the jobs. I definitely care about the jobs in West Virginia and Ohio and Kentucky and Wyoming, but that's not the main thing I'm talking about here. I'm talking about your point about the tax. So ultimately, energy is a key input to all economic equations, right? We would agree on that.
Yes.
Okay, so if you're going to tax carbon energy sources to make them lots more expensive, there's going to be a consequence for that in terms of an opportunity cost, in terms of GDP growth, right?
Not necessarily, because things can be made up other ways. When you tax carbon, you don't tax something else. Why do we tax work so much?
Well, we shouldn't tax Donald work so much.
Well, we do. Why Donald Trump wants to redo the tax code, it would be very easy to do in such a way that the carbon tax didn't hurt people as much. Can't you figure that out in the Senate?
We're not good at figuring a lot out in the Senate. Yeah, if you
all right,
if you want to think, go ahead.
No, I finish up because I got to get to the panel. But I could, you know.
It sounds like you're really disappointed to have these folks on the panel. They're good-looking folks.
No, I want to talk to them, and I want to talk to you again. But let's do it another time.
Okay.
In the meantime, let's remember that California has 40 million people, and Nebraska has
1.9,
and we have the same number of senators,
and we're still better at football.
Thank you very much. Senator Ben Sasse, appreciate you coming on.
Good to be on.
All right, let's meet our panel. He's good.
Charming. Dangerous.
Charming doesn't get it right.
Good and dangerous, they said. All right. Here's our panel. He is the Politico co-founder, who is now the co-founder and CEO of Axios Media, Jim Vandehei. How you, Jim? She's a writer-at-large for New York Magazine and has the current cover story on Hillary Clinton, Rebecca Traister. Hey, Rebecca. And the former governor of New York, my old state, Elliot Spitzer, is back here with us. Don't forget to send us your questions for tonight's overtime, so we can answer them after the show on YouTube. What do you think about that, what the senator was saying?
With all deference to the senator from Nebraska, everything he said about climate change was pure gibberish. Pure gibberish. He's nice guy, as Rebecca said, dangerous because he's
smart.
Charming. But I don't know, but listen, he's throwing out words. I'm going to be an arrogant New Yorker for a second. He throws around words like opportunity cost, and it's going to have this cost, and GDP is going to be hurt. He's wrong. And the CEO of Goldman, of General Electric, everybody on Wall Street, every mayor, virtually every governor,
Goldman Sachs,
every leader of every nation in the world is saying they're wrong, except the few states that think that coal is their economy. They're dangerous to the world, dangerous to the nation, and we have a president who's a lunatic who's listening to them. This is a problem.
There's another point of view.
I think that the governor also gets to a dynamic that I didn't expect to be happening so swiftly after we pull out of the Paris Accord, right? I expected the change in foreign policy power dynamics, right? We're going to fall behind the rest of the world. We're behind 193 countries. We're losing our moral and future-looking authority. I knew that was going to happen. The thing that's happened with the mayors and the governors and even the business leaders within 24 hours is really interesting in terms of the way it shakes up domestic power structures, because what we're seeing is this splintering. You have Jerry Brown saying, I'm going to go to China. Forget the federal government here. I'm going straight to China. You have a coalition of governors, mayors, cities, and states saying, we're going to go straight to NATO. We are going to meet or surpass these standards regardless of what our federal government does. And you have European leaders like Macron surpassing the president, talking directly to Americans. We understand you're not with this guy. And what you have is
states' rights.
Yes. No, it is an
states' rights. States' rights.
Yeah.
Jerry Brown, I want him to stand in the doorway of a school and block them. Trump from getting in.
We've seen this movie before. Yeah. When the federal government completely fails, it was like the Bush era on Wall Street, now the Trump era on the environment, other players will step forward, and that's good. That's the dynamism of American politics.
Jim? And this might be why the consequences aren't as severe as people think, because you do see companies are under tremendous pressure, social pressure, from shareholders, from voters, from consumers, in a way that they weren't 4 or 5 years ago. You saw it happen with Exxon this week, where they have their shareholders putting more pressure on that company to do things on the global warming fight that they wouldn't have done 4 or 5 years ago. And that's why one of the things I don't get, and we talk all the time to Trump's people about this decision, it was a political decision for him. He's not sitting there studying climate science and thinking deeply about the trends here. No, I'm sorry to tell you that. But It was a political decision for him. The White House has become obsessed with its base. Looking at the exact same polls, they're saying 98 to 99% of people who voted for Trump are still with him. And when push came to shove, he made the political decision, despite what his daughter wanted, despite what maybe his son-in-law wanted. And but not really any benefit other than that, because companies are against him, the world's against him, a lot of his party's against him, a lot of voters are against him.
Here's the harm, and Rebecca hit it on the head. It's not the economic harm, because I think you're right. Every other player will step into the void. But Donald Trump, within a matter of months, has sacrificed the U.S. leadership of the world. He's given up 80 years. Right. He is sacrificing. And you said it in your monologue. In 4.5 months, he has given away 80 years of a construct post-World War II that led to growth, freedom, democracy. He's thrown it out. And you know the big winner is? China. He ran against China, but he's given it all to China.
I got to say, the other big winner is Vladimir Putin.
But he's a thug. He's not going to last.
Yeah, but like this thing with pulling out of the Paris Accords, don't you think when he has his KGB reunion, they are drinking vodka and peeing on each other because... Well, really, I mean, Russia is a petrostate. Yeah. Right. And now the president of the United States says we want to go back to oil as much as we can. What else did Putin want? He wanted to drive a wedge between us and our allies. Our allies hate us now. Our government is in crisis. I mean, the return on investment for hacking our election could not have been better for him.
Hmm. I would add to that... In some ways, Putin's had a hell of a good 2 weeks, because if you go back to that foreign trip and what we did with Germany, the number one strategic objective for Russia right now is to loosen up the European coalition, to loosen up NATO. And by going and driving that wedge between us and Angela Merkel and the Germans, who I think every other president would have said is one of our top two or three allies around the world,
right.
Again, it's one of these things that's totally mystifying, because there's no upside. Sometimes you can say, I can kind of get the politics. I don't see the upside of that.
He's had a great 6 months, because he's ruined our country. Yeah. I mean, to the extent, he's diminished our power. Mm-hmm. All the other pieces of intrigue aside, he has diminished our power in the world, which is one of the things that he
not
wanted.
That is not a very strong country, Russia, that played a weak hand beautifully. Yeah. Yeah. By the way, I've said many times on this show in the last 6 months that this is a slow-moving coup. Mm-hmm. I once read the list of things that Trump does that sound like a third-world dictator. You put your name on buildings. You point your family members to positions of power. Your rallies are scary. You hate the press and talk about jailing reporters. You want missile parades. He doesn't have one, but he wants one. You use the office for financial gain. You love other dictators. You lie so freely, people can't tell the difference between truth and lies anymore. I left one out, which came to the fore this week, not that it hasn't been brewing. The constant, ridiculous, over-the-top flattery that the dear leader needs. Now, in North Korea, for example, Kim Jong-un, they say things like he learned to drive at the age of 3. Really. You know this about North Korea. The old man, the father, they said he trained his body so he never needed to urinate or defecate. He invented the hamburger. And still didn't need to defecate. That's quite a trick. When he was born, a new star was created, and winter turned to spring. The first time he played golf, he had 11 holes in one. This is us now. This is America. This is what is so scary. So, you know, I see where this is going. So we thought we would institute a new department here called the Ass Kisser of the Month. Because this is going on in America. This is just from the last couple of weeks. This is Judge Jeanine Pirro, our first nominee.
Our commander-in-chief, the pillar of strength and a true advocate for America.
Fox News commentator Corey Lewandowski.
Because he is the greatest communicator as a president we've ever had.
Here's Scott Pruitt yesterday.
Please know that I'm thankful for your fortitude, your courage, and your steadfastness.
And this even extends to other leaders, because other foreign leaders get the message you have to kiss his ass to get anything done. Listen to Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas.
I believe that we are capable, under your leadership, and your stewardship, to your courageous stewardship and your wisdom. We are, and as well as your great negotiating ability.
But the Ask Kisser of the Month award, and here it is. It's it's actually our. I have to be honest. We had a thing called the Head Up Their Ass Award. We've repurposed it. But Hope Hicks, the spokesman for the White House, Hope Hicks, this is something she wrote down. This is not an ad lib. I'm going to not read it all. President Trump has a magnetic personality and exudes positive energy. He has an unparalleled ability to communicate with people. He is brilliant with a great sense of humor. And this was... this was not the first draft of this. We got a hold of that. It was even worse. Would you like to hear it? Okay. Listen to this. His dirty socks have the aroma of lavender. And his balls taste like fresh-squeezed pineapple. He can start fires with his mind, but chooses not to, to save jobs in the matchstick industry. He was born when lightning struck a $100 bill. When he was in Jerusalem, the Wailing Wall slipped him a note. The reason he doesn't go to Camp David is because it makes the horses insecure about their penis size. He ejaculates magma, which hardens to form tropical islands where he builds exquisite resorts. His ass is so big because it's full of dreams for America. And women want him, men want to be him, and men also want him, even though they know he's not into that, but if he was, he'd be totally great at it. But, so... Am I exaggerating that it's funny as long as the movie we're watching is a comedy? But this is not really funny.
Right. Because... well, and you get the sense that the demand for this kind of inane adulation is there to prove that he's a big boy, right? Because he's a child prince, right? Like, it's like the driving as a three-year-old, right? He's the boy prince running around to Europe, touching the orb, riding a golf cart, arm wrestling, whatever. And so the only way, there's no way that you could rationally or with any nuance praise his authority or competence. So what you're left with and what he must demand is this stupidity.
You know, when I was watching the announcement the other day when he withdrew from Paris, I had to turn it off because of the nature of these introductions. It's too embarrassing to watch. But what strikes me is that you have narcissism on steroids, which is something beyond we've ever seen, combined with a paranoia, which is Nixonian, and the dystopian worldview. And it's those three that mix together that create this completely dangerous set of policies that he's inflicting upon us. And it's scary.
Here's a... We spend a lot of time talking to people in the Trump White House. So what's most interesting and why this is so much a new form of propaganda is that they're playing to an audience of one when they're on TV. They know he spends an inordinate amount of time watching TV. He actually has like a big TV in
the
side.
They communicate with him through the TV.
He watches spicy briefing and then does it like he's an ESPN analyst saying how he did or didn't do. But here's what's interesting is that you have, when you talk to them, when they're not on camera, they don't pretend. They don't talk like he's the dear leader. They're super aware of the flaws that he has. And they're very uncomfortable inside the White House. They don't trust him. They don't trust that he has their back. But then you see it on TV.
That's the proof, is they leak.
And the creepiest thing was when he got Pruitt to come up in the Rose Garden speech, because it was so obvious and so staged. You know, now Pruitt's going to come up and say a few words, and then Pruitt came up and said, "You're really wonderful." And it was like, does he not think that we notice that he just did that? He truly thinks that nobody sees his masterminding of the situation. And I think that that sense that everybody out there is so stupid is a sign of how stupid he is.
Well, of course it is.
Except
But the problem is that he is the decider, and he makes decisions. Right. And the word has gotten out even to the other world leaders. The way you get what you want is when you sit down with them, first tell them about how the electoral victory, we're all buzzing about it in Ankara. And then keep it short, because he's got the attention span of a squirrel on meth. So don't...
You know, I wish I agreed with you about how his being that stupid, but the problem is, as we just said, he won the election. And so the problem we got is that he did outsmart us, and somehow we're stuck with the result.
I don't know if it was that he outsmarted us. We might have been as stupid as he thought he thought we were.
One way or another, it ain't good. Okay. It ain't good.
Let's bring out Tristan. He is a former design ethicist at Google who is now the co-founder of the Time Well Spent movement. Please welcome Tristan Harris. Hey. How are you, sir? Great to see you. All right. Well, you know, this is the second time you're on our show because you were a clip of you was in my ending monologue
Which
a couple of weeks ago. Yes, people did not like it so much. They do not like to hear that they're wasting their lives on Facebook. But I'm going to shove it down their throat, and I wanted you back to just to make that point again. First of all, tell us what a design ethicist or a technological ethicist is.
Well, so I was at Google and a design ethicist, which is really how do you study how to ethically manipulate what 2 billion people think every day? Because if you're a technology company...
Ethically manipulate. Isn't that itself an oxymoron?
Well, so if you think about it, if Google or Apple bumps its elbow into 1 billion people's minds, it goes that way, or they could go that way. So no matter what we do, 1 billion people's minds are jacked into an environment that a handful of technology companies make. And so I got really interested in how do you ethically steer what so many people are thinking and believing? Because the consequences are obviously huge in terms of, say, Facebook and 50% of an election year.
And the election,
You know, we're in Facebook. So when I was a kid, I was a magician as well. So I studied basically how do people's minds get manipulated in ways they don't see. And that's what made me so sensitive to these topics.
And tell us, I love that analogy you made on 60 Minutes about the slot machine.
Yep.
That the phone is really a slot machine, and every time people are checking, they want to get some sort of goose.
I mean, it's built into our brains a variable schedule reward. So if you pull a lever and sometimes you get a reward and sometimes you don't, sometimes you get a reward like you're invited to the Bill Maher show, and sometimes you pull your lever and you get a newsletter on an email you want to throw away, it makes it addictive. And so everything about our phone accidentally becomes a slot machine because it could be a text message from someone you love or it could be nothing. But the more frequently it buzzes, the more it conditions us to check more. And so it's obviously leading to these kind of addictive problems that everybody feels.
Right.
And the amazing thing is the scale.
That's your real point, is that these companies, and that's what I was saying in this essay a couple of weeks ago, is that companies just like the tobacco companies, just like food companies, it's not enough that we just like the product. We have to be addicted to it.
Right.
And that is something kind of evil.
Well, and the reason, though, that this we need you to use it as much as possible thing comes from is because of the attention economy. There's only so much attention.
The attention economy. Yeah, right.
Because when information gets abundant, the only thing that's left is attention gets scarce because there's only our lives to fit it inside of. So then it becomes hyper-competitive.
And the reason people are stupider, to your point, is because they don't read anymore. And the reason they don't read, there's no time.
Yep.
Because they're doing this bullshit.
Well, and because this race for attention means I have to go lower on the brainstem. So I would do better in the attention economy if I offer you a short, simple story soundbite that confirms your beliefs about the world than if I show you a complex, nuanced, oh, man, the world is really complicated. We don't have time for that. And the more it invisibly becomes this slippery slope down to what we're in right now.
It's important to remember that we are not Facebook's customers. The advertisers
That's
are
right.
their customers, and the product is our eyeballs.
Yes.
Right?
Well, the thing is that any attention-based company, Snapchat, Netflix, meditation apps, they all need more attention to be successful. Even Netflix, which is a subscription-based business, still needs people's attention to be successful. They need to maximize how much attention, because if they don't do that, they lose their subscribers. So if everyone in the attention economy wants as much attention as possible, it ruins our minds.
So how do we prevent social media from not being a delivery system for fake news? Because Hillary Clinton was out talking about this week. She said the other side was using content that was just flat out false and delivering it in a very personalized way.
Yeah.
If you look at Facebook, the vast majority of the news items posted were fake. What do we do about this?
Well, I mean, so the thing is, there's this myth that technology is neutral, that it's up to us to choose how we use it. Therefore, these platforms are not responsible. It is not true. Because the these companies, not because they're evil, but they need to get as much attention as possible.
They're evil.
So if something that is sensational, something is sensational, they have to show you the sensational thing that gets more attention than if they showed you complex things that got less attention. They have to. And, you know, anybody who runs a website or, you know, knows this.
What do you think about that, Rebecca? You wrote this big article about Hillary this week. Do you think she's being real about this?
She's being real about all of it. I think
She went a lot further than we've seen before about charging collusion with the Russians.
Yeah, she's certainly being real about what she thinks, which is unusual. This is a really unvarnished view. she really is sort of letting... She has a little bit of a don't-give-a-fuck attitude that we have never seen in 25 years of Hillary in the national spotlight.
Well, that's probably because now she could not give a fuck.
Right,
because, what is there left?
Right, but this is actually crucial, and I know that there are lots of calls for her to shut up and go away and all that, but she's a really fascinating historic figure. She is the only person in 230 years of presidential history in the United States to have run for the presidency as a woman. And so, and she is talking very candidly about her perceptions of what that experience was like, about the obstacles she feels she faced. We may not like the way that she's talking about it. It may irritate us. But there is this sense in which her ability to speak freely at this point, I think, is offering us something of value as a nation. We need to think about the fact that we have massive gender inequality at the heart of our
institution. But as long as she's out there... Doesn't it? I mean, usually when people lose, they go away for a while. Now, I know this is different.
No. Wait. I want to say something about that because I've heard a lot of that.
All right.
John Kerry loses the presidency in November of 2004 to George W. Bush.
Right.
Let me tell you, you can look up this transcript. He is on Meet the Press in January of 2005, talking in language that almost replicates the way that Hillary is talking right now. Sure, you know, of course I take responsibility, but we did so well. Look at all the votes we got. He blames the Osama bin Laden tape. It's actually a pretty solid mirror of the kind of stuff that Hillary is talking about now, specifics
but
being different.
Be that as it may, does it not help Trump? Because as long as she's out there, they can then point to Hillary and rile up the rubes all over again.
Well,
and it distracts from Trump's problems, which are legion.
But I don't think it may be problematic. I do not think the solution is to rush her off the stage. And one of the things that she's doing that's interesting is trying to direct her attention and the money through this C4 thing that she's got, where she's taking her fundraising hose and applying it to these...
Her fundraising hose?
Yeah, I know. to these grassroots groups that are trying to bring... No, you're not allowed to make a joke.
I'm not going
Did you mean like a fire hose?
To all of these grassroots groups that are bringing new people, women, young people, people of color into the system, outsiders into the system, and trying to amplify their voices.
Let me say this. I think you're right. One of my favorite quotes in the world is Teddy Roosevelt. The credit goes, apologize for the pronoun, but back then, the credit goes to the man in the arena, not to the critic. She's been in the arena for 25 years, deserves to have her moment to explain whatever she wants. But there's a but coming after this, which is at a certain point, we as a Democratic Party have got to stop looking backwards and have to look forwards.
Thank you.
We've got elections in 17 and 18 that matter. And if we can't let new candidates get out there and run for office at the local level in 17 and the national level in 18 to take back the House so we can chase out Paul Ryan, we're going to be stuck. And to a certain extent, we're not letting that happen
yet. That is a really important point. I think... There's a lot of liberal enthusiasm right now, and I think there's a liberal assumption, especially out here, that there's going to be impeachment. If there's not impeachment, that Democrats are going to win back the House. Democrats are not good at off-year elections. Republicans are. Guess who votes in off-year elections? Old white people. Guess who they like? Republicans. So unless Democrats take that energy, the people who are turning out of town halls, the people who are protesting, and start voting, you could easily have Trump with the Republican Congress for 4 years. And, I'm sorry, he could be reelected.
And also, I don't think he will. I have to bring up one more point, and it goes back to the Paris Accords a little. But there is a Republican congressman who commented on the Trump pulling out by saying, there is a creator in God who is much bigger than us. If there's a real problem, he can take care of it. Which begs the question, why do we need Congressman Tim Walberg? Pruitt is from the Bible Belt. He's from Oklahoma. These people really believe the Bible and the Bible Belt. Make no mistake, the role of fundamentalism and how it played into this pulling out of the climate war. These people really believe that God promised Noah after the flood that he would never try to wipe out people again. So why are we worrying about climate change? They really believe that. That's why fundamentalism is so bad.
You know, it is amazing when you look at the Paris Accords, not to spend too much time on that issue, I guess, but he had Steve Bannon and Scott Pruitt as really the only two voices in the White House who were pushing him to pull out. He rejected everybody else. And Bannon and Pruitt, if you think that they are the most powerful voices for this president, that is scary, scary stuff, right?
Very scary. Yeah, but I'm just saying, the people in America, who are many, who see Jesus in their pancakes. Do not think that this is a problem because of this Jesus will take the wheel bullshit. Now, we saw fundamentalism in Manchester the week we were off, and it was horrible, and I'm not drawing a false equivalency. I'm the one who's always saying the equivalency shouldn't be false on this issue. But we do have fundamentalists here in this country.
Sure.
And this... and it's not as bad as that, but it is bad. And that is something we should think about.
Well, look, the crime data about the white supremacists who commit awful crimes here is dangerous and scary. There are a lot of them.
Not as scary as Islamic.
No. Again, I'm with you on this. What we have going on here in the white supremacist movement has got to be looked at. It is dangerous. It is the fanaticism that is the domestic analog.
Yes.
Right?
I mean, but I hear that all the crazy idea about what about the Ku Klux Klan? Give me a break about the Ku Klux Klan.
No.
They don't have a caliphate. They're not trying to.
No. I'm not saying the two are anything close. I'm with you that the real threat is fanaticism and fundamental radical Islam. I'm fine saying that. I'm happy saying that.
Right.
But we got a domestic issue as well.
I couldn't agree more.
The threat is human beings who have an impulse toward oppression, violence, and bias, and who look to all kinds of fundamentalist religions to offer them a framework to justify it.
Okay.
And that's...
But that is not spread equally out among cultures. The World Economic Forum did a study about 3 years ago. Women... Gender equality. They studied 134 countries. 17 of the bottom 20 were Muslim countries. Let's not bullshit about
this. Right, but 98% of mass violence, mass killings are committed by men, and 57% of mass violence, mass murders in the United States are committed by men who have a history of domestic abuse or who kill partners. I mean, the degree to which, even more than the religious view that you want to make the argument that there's a pattern based on religion, the far more prevalent pattern in across religions is a history of open misogyny, records of domestic violence and sexual assault. And those men looking to religions, and I agree with you. I agree with you. I am not crazy
about one religion sanctions that in the modern world more than others.
In different ways than others.
We gotta go to new rules or else my head's gonna explode. New rules, everybody. Liberals. New rules. Countries like Canada and France have to admit they're electing young, vital, handsome leaders just to rub our faces in it. New rule, instead of driving all the way to Burger King for their new macaroni and cheese deep-fried mozzarella sticks, just lie down in the driveway and have your wife back over your chest. New rule, people who write no words to accompany their Facebook posts have to admit what they really mean is, I can't think of anything interesting to say. Here's a crazy thought. Instead of saying you have no words, just don't type any words. New rule, no words. No words. But Trump voters have to admit, if it was Obama in this picture stroking an orb with an Arab and his vampire bride, they would burn the White House to the ground. I don't know what's scarier, the people in this picture, the orb, or the look on Melania's face that... The look on Melania's face that says, not the weirdest thing I've ever done with him. New rule, you can't claim that your frozen supermarket lasagna is made daily. When else would it be made? Yearly? Over eons? Yes, you made this lasagna during a day. But then you froze it, and it sat at the Piggly Wiggly for 6 months. And then I got it stoned and ate it at 3 a.m. And finally, new rule, when it comes to how you run for office, there has to be a middle ground between body-slamming reporters and whatever it is the Democrats are doing. You may have seen last week that on the eve of a special election for the House seat in Montana, a ridiculous bald bastard named Greg Gianforte, running for the Republicans, physically assaulted a reporter for asking a question about health care.
I'm sick and tired of you guys. The last time you came here, you did the same thing.
And then he won the election by 7 points. Naturally, Democrats were ecstatic because Trump won the state by 20. So we beat the spread. We beat the spread. You know, we keep having these special elections where Democrats keep almost winning. And by that, I mean losing. Since 2009, Democrats have lost over 800 seats in state legislatures. They don't control a single chamber in the South. They only have 16 governors. Even Radio Shack is like, how are you guys still in business? After Congressman-elect Gianforte was charged with assault, reporters approached his Democratic opponent, who said nothing. He declined to comment. And here's the radio ad the fearsome Democrats made after the assault.
If Greg Gianforte could be sentenced to jail, should he really be elected to Congress?
Ooh, burn. Yes, there's nothing that moves voters in Butte, Montana like Socratic irony. You know, the Democrat symbol is a mule, because that's the other animal that just stands there when you beat it. In the summer of 2016, President Obama knew the Russian meddling was 100% targeted to elect Trump and chose not to say anything. He didn't use it because he was afraid of how it would look. Republicans never care how things look. Did Mitch McConnell care how it looked when he stole Obama's Supreme Court pick? No, he did it for the same reason a dog licks his balls, because he can. For decades, Republicans accused Democrats of being soft on Russia. Now we got a Republican president who isn't just soft on Russia, he's totally hard for it. Everyone he knows has had secret meetings with the Russians and lied about it, including the National Security Advisor, the Attorney General, and the royal son-in-law. They hijack the election, and he invites them into the Oval Office, gives them secret intel, admits to obstruction of justice on TV. But when asked about impeachment, Nancy Pelosi says...
What are the facts that you would make a case on? What are the rules that he may have violated? If you don't have that case, you're just participating in more hearsay.
Yo, look below you. It says Trump shared classified information with the Russian foreign minister. Would Republicans be so reserving of judgment even after Hillary was exonerated? They were chanting, lock her up, not wait and see. It's one thing to bring a knife to a gunfight. The Democrats are bringing a covered dish. Adam Schiff says no one ought to rush to embrace the most extraordinary remedy that removes the president. And Eric Swalwell concurs. He says we need to assemble all the facts. Facts? Have you listened to this administration? Facts don't count anymore. They're disdained. They're pariahs. They're Charlie Sheen's dick. When they go low, we go high is a great applause line. But as a tactic, what country do you think you're living in now? Wake up and smell the asshole. Because it turns out when they go low, they get reelected. They take the Congress, the Supreme Court, the presidency. From now on, the Democratic motto should be, when they go low, we kick them in the nuts. Democrats have to start actually winning elections. I want some candidates on my team who can at least metaphorically body slam the Republicans. They put a journalist in the hospital, we put a lobbyist in the mall. Last year, Republican Congressman Michael McCaul said about Hillary's infamous private server, he said, in my opinion, quite frankly, it's treason. See, they're not afraid to say the T word about nothing. Her private server was treason? No, Trump being Putin's private server, that's treason. All right, I'll be at the Mirage in Vegas July 14th and 15th. I want to thank Jim Vandehyde, Rebecca Traister, Elliot Spitzer, and Senator Ben Sasse. Join us now, folks, for Overtime on YouTube. Thank you very much.
Catch all new episodes of Real Time with Bill Maher every Friday night at 10, or watch him anytime on HBO On Demand. For more information, log on to HBO.com.